Made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Edward Conlin is a Harvard-educated and fourth-generation cop in New York City. Why did he make the choice to join the force, and what's the day-to-day life like for a police officer in the nation's biggest city? Conlin addresses those questions in a new book, Blue Blood. Let me share an excerpt from the book, Conlin's Early Days on the Force. What do you got? That's what the boss asks when he arrives at the scene to make a decision or review one you've made. You got to have a story, as they say. You tell him, I got a dispute, a matched pair of bloody noses, a shaky ID on a chain snatch. I got a lady with a stopped-up toilet who thinks I'm going to help mop the bathroom. I got an order of protection that says I have to throw the husband out of the house, but he has custody of the three kids because she's a junkie and they have nowhere to go. I have 27 facts in front of me, too many and not enough, in a broken heap like they fell off the back of a truck that left yesterday. What do you got? I got nothing, Sarge, and plenty of it. Good work, officer. I knew you had it in you. That from Edward Conlin's memoir, Blue Blood. In this book, he also writes about the struggles and successes of a force of 40,000 policing a city of more than 7 million. Edward Conlin is our guest today on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a detective with the New York City Police Department. He's also published articles in The New Yorker in addition to this book, Blue Blood. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Edward Conlin's book, Blue Blood, is published by Riverhead Books. Edward Conlin, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. How often in the space of a day, the space of a week, does an officer in New York City answer that question, what do you got?
Every day, at least. You know, some things are simple, but a lot of times, especially when you're expecting them to be, they take you by surprise. I have, you know, I had what seemed to be a very simple case just the other week of a guy who had his watch stolen by a kid who worked for him. And but when I went to talk to the kid, he wasn't there, and this other kid walks in. Who are you? Oh, I'm his twin brother. You know, I'm his twin brother, Joe. So he takes us out to the car, or he follows us out to the car, and he says, listen, you know, my brother and I don't get along, but when he came home that day, I knew something was up, and I don't want to say he took it, but and it was pretty persuasive when a guy's identical twin, you know, is basically saying, you know, he's the guy who did it. But when we brought in, you know, we had a lot of negotiations with his mother to, you know, have them both come in, and we talk to the kid and figure out exactly what happened. And he had a very strong story. He said, listen, I didn't do it. I didn't take it. He didn't see me. And, you know, you can't prove it. And he was more or less right. We couldn't, unless we got a statement. It was one of these situations where the watch was there and then it wasn't there. It was a $20,000 watch. You know, the next day I get a call from the victim who had been talking to the family. And he said, we all got swindled. I mean, the one kid... There was never any, it was one brother all along pretending to be both. So he both pretended to be a guy who mistrusted his brother, and then he pretended to be the brother in fierce denial of all these things. And the mother was in on the plot, and I wound up locking up all of them. And I just got the watch back yesterday.
Well, you point out that, you know, you may only have seconds to take stock, to sort out a situation, you know, who's telling the right story, what, you know, what are the allegations. And you say that good cops are method actors. You also say sometimes when in doubt, it's better not to do something. It's better just to stand there. How do you go about sorting it out?
Well, it depends on the circumstance, and you get it wrong a lot of the times. I mean, but you certainly have to. I mean, if everybody's running away from the sound of gunshots, and everybody's pointing to that guy, I mean, it may well be one of the people who are running away and pointing is the guy who was shooting. And sometimes you can't stop everybody, but sometimes you just got to grab a hold of somebody, and very often your instincts are right about that. I wish there was a better rule book. you play it, you take it as you come.
Yeah. When do you just stand there and don't do anything?
Well, if there's too many people fighting for you to do much about, you know, you might be one of the early losers in the fight. That, you know, you step back and you call for help, and you know, a lot of times that can be a kind of street situation where you might want to where discretion is the better part of wisdom or valor, whichever it turns out to be. Other times you just let people talk. I mean, I'm a detective now in a robbery squad. As long as you get people talking, they'll say things that illuminate the situation in ways you didn't expect. This is when I was on patrol, but I had this lady who claimed to have been robbed by three guys, and she was kind of a strange seeming woman, but she didn't really speak English, so you always have to be careful when the communication is off, what's a language barrier and what's, you know, mental illness sometimes. But she said that three white guys had broken into her apartment. I said, okay, what did they take? A pack of cigarettes. Well, you know, for home invasion, these things happen. But in this neighborhood, they're not usually three white guys. And additionally, she described them as wearing white suits. So, you know, before I put out an APB on the Bee Gees, I decided to talk to her for a while. And I said, you know, are you hurt? Should I call an ambulance? And she said, no, she was fine. And I sort of try and draw her out a little bit more. I said, well, you know, sometimes you don't realize in the shock of a situation like that, it's better to have, somebody look at you. We're going to call an ambulance and have them see how you're doing. One of the things they have to know is, are you taking any medications right now? And she said, yeah, I take some pills. I said, well, what are they for? Oh, they're for the voices I hear. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you know, the Bee Gees are free to go today.
Yeah, yeah. Listening is an important part of the job. Also, respect, although respect is a kind of funny thing in this job, and it's maybe you talk about that.
Yeah, it's, respect, it means everything and nothing. I mean, there was a drug dealer who, when I was on my beat, who I gave a pretty hard time to. Whenever I caught him an inch out of line, you know, he got stopped, he got searched. I locked him up a couple of times, but if he didn't have anything on him and there was nothing to do at the moment, I let him go and said, there you go, sorry, you know, but next time be careful, and we both know what this is about. But it was never personal. If I got him, I got him, and he didn't, he didn't. And I was really surprised to hear him say, you know, tell me one day, you know, you treat me with respect. Well, that's a funny idea of respect, but, you know, at the same time, you know, just because, you know, cops go in and they have to go in hard, they got to grab people, they got to stop people, they, you know, this is the nature of the business, and you're not going to get it right every time, but you apologize, you try and explain, you know, this is the description person we were looking for. Sometimes, if it's possible, if it's necessary, you'll even, you'll have your radio and say, you know, Central, can I get a script of that from that robbery perp? And they'll play it back, and they'll believe you. And, you know, not everybody's going to walk away happy, but that kind of, you know, retail respect can make a lot of things go smoother.
Mm. What you say and how you say it is important. Is that part of your training, or is that something you develop in uniform?
It's something they try and train. Obviously, it doesn't, you know, stick for everybody. And it's part of your character. It's part of your background. And training can bring it, you know, to another level, but, you know, you gotta have something there to begin with.
Yeah. Like you say, it's something maybe you have or you don't have from a young age. I'm remembering a little anecdote from the book where you once saw a little guy silence some nasty drunk in a pizza parlor by saying, hey, there's ladies in here.
That's right. It worked. He shut up.
Yeah.
I mean, that kid obviously had a real presence, and he knew how to talk the talk, and it worked.
Yeah. What kind of kid were you?
Oh, I think quiet. I was I had a nice big family. I was the second out of five, and I don't know. We were. I liked to read. I had my friends. I guess a pretty regular kid, but I liked to read quite a bit.
And when did you begin writing?
Always I'd written. Always I'd wanted to be a writer. That's one of the things that led me to the job, aside from, you know, growing up. And my father was a cop for a short time, but an FBI agent for a long time, and his brother was a cop for over 30 years, and going back to my great-grandfather. So anybody, you know, who grows up on cop stories really, you know, sort of keeps them with them. But I'd done some writing, and I'd... most of the stories I'd written were about crime in the city, and aside from friends who were cops, I was talking to these cops about their jobs, and I came to see that nobody loved the job the way these people did when it was going good. I mean, nothing really grabbed you the way the work held on to these people.
Hmm. You could have been a journalist, though.
Yeah, well, I kind of am.
Yeah. That's right. But so writing pulled you into the force, that and the stories that you told, you heard growing up.
Yeah, and well, it was a couple of things that came together. I mean, I had the first piece that I wrote as a journalist was when I was talking to a good friend of mine, it was right around the time of the Rodney King beatings, and just, you know, when friends were talking, and he said, you know, listen, you wouldn't believe what people put you through, the way they scream at you, they spit on you. He said, I bet you couldn't go for 2 weeks without wanting to punch somebody in the face. And I said, I'll take that bet. And I rode around with him. He was a cop in the subways in a plainclothes robbery squad. They'd kind of float around and, you know, wait for things to happen. And, I put in a lot of city history and subway history in it, and that was the first piece that I had written. So, you know, that was as a journalist, but a foot through the door to becoming a police officer.
Now, was that the first piece that went to the New Yorker?
No, that didn't go to the New Yorker. That went to the American Spectator, which ran a lot of, I mean, it's a conservative political magazine, but they took the regular city stories that, you know, went in the New Yorker or elsewhere. But the first New Yorker piece was about Potter's Field, which is where unknown and unclaimed mm-hmm. bodies go in New York. And again, that sort of came out of my childhood because my uncle, who was a cop, worked in the Harbor Patrol, and like a lot of cops, he, you know, kind of spent a lot of his weekends on his boat. And I remember as a kid either going right up to it or, if not on it, my uncle thought it was a fun idea to go on this island of the dead, and my father didn't think it was such a good idea, and I don't remember whether we actually set foot on the shores, but what happens, I mean, there's 850,000 bodies buried there, and it's in a little island in the Sound, Long Island Sound, and they ferry bodies over, and, they wait in the morgue for a couple of weeks, and if nobody wants them or if nobody knows who they are, they go up to Potter's Field, and then they ferry over inmates from Rikers Island to do the burial detail. So it's like something out of Greek mythology. And it took a while to do it just because the Department of Corrections runs it, and you know, you go on their schedule. They're nice enough to let me on, but in the meantime, I talked to a detective from Missing Persons who sort of, what he does is, you know, the bodies come in from the river, from wherever they do, and he tries to match them with the reports, you know, my uncle disappeared, my wife is gone, and so mm-hmm. forth, and he puts the paper with the bodies, and this amazing woman named Peggy Caldwell, who was a forensic anthropologist, and she was the bone lady. What she would do is that cops would say, find some bones in a park, and they'd bring it in to her, and she'd say, relax, it's only spare ribs, or, you know, this is a human shin bone, but it's probably about 200 years old, or, you know, this is a fresh one, we got something important here. So it was a complicated story about New York City. That was the first one that got into the New Yorker.
Yeah. Now, and when you wrote that piece, you weren't yet working on the force?
No, that was a couple of years before I became a cop.
Okay. So Were you writing under the name Edward Conlin for that first
piece? Yeah, the only one I had at the time.
And then later you wrote pieces for The New Yorker about being a police officer, and you used the name Marcus Laffey, which comes from a family name, your father's mother, Delia Laffey.
That's right.
That name. Eventually, though, here you've laid aside the pseudonym.
Well, I wrote a piece, you know, I one of the reasons I look forward to becoming a cop or enjoyed being a cop was that I wouldn't have to depend on freelance writing as making a living. And so I said, you know, listen, if I want to write a novel, I'll write a novel. And I, you know, well, I'll know I'll have a paycheck every other Thursday. And maybe I'll like it, which I certainly did. But a year or two in, The New Yorker asked me to write a piece about being a cop. And I decided, just because I was new enough on the job, and I didn't want to make the other cops I worked with self-conscious. Nobody likes the feeling of being watched unawares. And I decided to use another name. You know, Laffey after my grandmother, and Marcus came after a college roommate, Mark Dieter, who was killed in a motorcycle accident.
Hmm. What kind of reaction did the columns receive in the department when you were writing under that pseudonym, Marcus Laffey?
It was favorable, but it was pretty small. I don't think there's a huge number of New Yorker readers among the cops, but it was they were pretty narrow and focused. They were just sort of, this is what it's like to do this job. This is the funny thing that happened. This is what it's like to work a narcotics set. It wasn't talking about the other cops. It wasn't, you know, launching into the great issues of the day, whatever they might be. It was. Pretty specific first person, this is what it's like stuff. And it was, you know, the stories of a guy who was very happy to be doing what he was doing. So, I mean, they were favorable pieces if the department wanted to, you know, put them in one column or another. So it was fine, and it was pretty low-key.
Yeah. Now, the book, Blue Blood, when was it known that you were writing the book, and how was that situation different from writing the columns?
Well, when I got, I mean, that was, you know, 5.5 years ago. I mean, that book didn't come quickly with my day job. But I had, and unfortunately, there was some news coverage when I got the book deal, and my name got out of the papers. And in one way, you know, I'm glad that that's all passed. But it made for a tough year. I mean, I got things pretty completely backwards in terms of how other cops would react to, a writer or a reporter in their midst. I thought the regular cops, rank and file, would be, you know, suspicious or jealous or somehow small-minded, whereas the bosses would be a little too excited, you know, wanting me to work here with them. And it was the cops who I worked with, you know, were happy, were proud. There was a couple of attaboys, and then you move on. Whereas we had a new captain who was really worried and concerned about it, and kept on saying, "Who is this guy I think he is? Some kind of Serpico?" And it made for a couple of other reasons, you know, for a pretty rotten year after the news came out at work.
Yeah.
But since then, it's been fine, you know. And I've been back at work for a little over a week now, and I've been where I am for about 3 years, and I'd worked in the other place for a couple of years too. So people know me as a cop and as a person, and you know, the writing stuff is just an interesting bit of trivia to the side.
Yeah, being a Harvard grad now, was that a bit of trivia, or did it raise eyebrows? Did it cause any problems?
Well, I sort of put it in the same category as writing, even though it came first. It was until people knew me, I wanted to keep this stuff to myself. And I did, you know, with mixed success, we'll call it, you know, from the get-go, from the academy. I had, you had to fill out these background questionnaires, you know, were you in the Army? Can you speak another language? Can you drive a truck? You know, where did you go to school? And I wrote in this kind of cramped scribble, Howard, you know, I just figured nobody should, nobody really needed to know that. And I got away with it for a couple of weeks until Sergeant Solosky, one of my teachers, suddenly interrupted the class and he says, "Conlin, there's some rumor going around that you went to Harvard." And I said, "Not lately, Sarge." And he took me aside, and I took him aside after class and said, "You know, listen, Sarge, I did go there." And he patted me on the back and said, "It's nothing to be ashamed of."
Now, you always carried a book. What kinds of things were you reading? Did you have the New Yorker, for example, with you?
Yeah, that fits in the pocket. Yeah. You know, in the uniform jacket, you get nice big pockets, which is better. It's a terrible thing about the way they make paperback books now. They're big. They're almost as big as hardcovers, and you can't stuff them in your pocket as easy anymore. Everything, you know, from novels to history, and tons of police books, good and bad. Most of them weren't too good. But as I started writing about it, there was quite a bit of history to absorb about New York and its police officers. But anything, from Nabokov to Serpico.
Mm. Edward Conlon is our guest today here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a detective in robbery with the New York City Police Department. He's also a writer. He's published articles in The New Yorker, among other publications. And he's also the author of Blue Blood, a memoir that is published by Riverhead Books. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Eureka on the toll-free line, line 4. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. A very interesting conversation. Sir, could you give maybe what, in your mind, may be the one or two or three greatest misconceptions the general public has about being a policeman or a policewoman?
Well, I mean, to put it one way, the biggest surprise that I had when I started out as a cop, and I worked the whole time and going on 10 years in the South Bronx, I started out walking a beat in a housing project, in kind of the class, the most famous bad neighborhood in America, maybe, it's Fort Apache. And most people really liked cops. They were really happy to see you there. I mean, you were important to see the guy in a blue suit on the street corner. It meant that people could get home and get to work without being assaulted or bothered in the way that is what people in bad neighborhoods have to suffer through. I mean, this is a very big, pretty nasty housing project, and it was maybe what? I would guess that 20%, 25% of the people who live there are what make it a ghetto. Everybody else is trying to get by and do better and raise their kids and do all the right things that everybody else is trying to do. So they were, for the most part, pretty happy to see it. That to me was the biggest surprise and the biggest misconception, because when things go bad, generally with the police in cities, it is along racial lines, and that does happen. There can be pretty fierce conflict sometimes, but as a white cop in a black neighborhood, I had a pretty good time with people.
Could I ask one more question, please?
Sure.
I have talked to policemen. I have some property, and from time to time, they're very useful. I do appreciate them. And one thing that always strikes me, and you hear it when you hear police interviews, is that the best thing they like about the job is there's such a tremendous variety, and one day is never the same as the other. Did you find that to be true in your own experience?
Oh, that's the best thing. One of the best things about the job. I mean, what I do is I knock on a door and somebody has to tell me a story. What's better than that? And you're always surprised. We're almost always surprised. You see a lot of the same things, but the twists keep on coming.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. You say it was a revelation to see how many people in the South Bronx liked cops, but of course there are folks who don't like cops that you were probably well aware of, right?
Oh, sure. And sometimes they're the same people. If somebody just gave you, if you ask the question, do you like cops? Well, if you were just robbed and they're running around trying to help you, you love the cops. If they're the guys who just wrote you a parking ticket that you didn't feel like you deserved, you hate those jerks. Everybody, it's not as simple or as constant as it is some generally portrayed. I mean, these are complex situations. They're complex relationships, but they're better, in my view, than is generally portrayed.
Well, tell us about Mrs. Cunningham. She was a member of a tenant patrol in one of the buildings that you patrolled, and you kind of had a run-in with her son.
We did not get off on the right foot. I mean, this was a really nasty building. I mean, it was 1385 Washington Avenue. It was a baby overdosed, eating crack from the table that his mother and his father were packing up. There was homicides and rapes and a couple of really bad families. And Mrs. Cunningham was kind of one of these, you know, classic, project mamas, as I call them. You know, she's out a lot. She's mostly yelling at people, and mostly she's right when she's yelling, you know, stop doing this, get over there, I'll tell your mother, I'll whoop you. And, you know, she had a teenage son who was out with his friends one night, and I don't even remember what he did, but he was acting up. And, you know, I wrote him a ticket for disorderly conduct, and his mother was not happy about it. She got right in my face, and she was bellowing, why don't you catch the bad guys? Why don't you catch the killers? Why don't you do this? I said, listen, lady, you know, he was out drinking a beer, whatever he was doing. You know, he's getting the ticket, so you're going to have to live with it. But this is the kind of ugly, you know, low-grade confrontation that happens a lot, and it's no fun for anybody. But it's what you got to do sometimes just to keep the peace on the block. And so we did not start out as good friends, but both she and this other lady pretty much by themselves decided to start a tenant patrol. And they'd park their little bridge table in the lobby and have their sign-in sheet. And Miss Cunningham and Miss Smith, you know, we couldn't have been more different ladies. One was this very quiet, proper church lady. And Miss Cunningham was like an A-train, you know. She would get out of the way if you don't like what's coming. And, you know, we got to be pretty good pals because that was one of the situations where you just stand there, you know. I'm standing in that lobby. That means that whoever's coming in to buy crack is going to maybe think twice, and whoever's going to think about going maybe hanging up in the stairwell and robbing a crackhead is going to have to think twice. So we spent a good bit of time together and came away with a different impression than the one we went in with.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I am calling because I was a reporter, and I was covering the public housing beat in our local community for a period of time. And while I met some women there that were very spiritual and powerfully motivated to change things, I found myself getting discouraged. Hearing all the different multiple stories and some of the contradictions in them. And I found it eventually to be erosive and stressful. And I wondered how you dealt with that and what you did to keep up your spirits and not to be pulled down by kind of the broken lives that that you have contact with. And then I'll hang up and let you talk.
Well, it was tough. I mean, at one point there was a couple of fires in the stairwells. Homeless people, mattresses, crack, whatever it was. And they got some news coverage that that it wasn't as safe. The paint wasn't safe. And then with some fanfare, the housing authority, repainted all of the stairwells of thousands of buildings with fireproof paint, which led lots of people to test whether it really was fireproof. So there was a spate of fires, and it was not, in fact, fireproof. And there were fires all over the place, which meant that, they just had to strip them down to the bare cinder block and concrete. So, you know, they're filthy and reek of urine, and that's how that great social experiment ended. It can be tremendously frustrating, and I definitely got burnt out towards the end. And changed. I went to a narcotics unit. I did it and I liked it, but I didn't want to and I couldn't do it forever. I liked doing it. And for people to spend a lifetime doing it, you know, God bless them. I mean, I never left the area. I just, you know, change of assignment here and there. Narcotics patrol and now in a robbery squad. But it's the same area, but very, very tough. I mean, you just got to get some fresh air now and then. I mean, cops in New York are very badly paid, but they get more time off than Frenchmen. It's necessary.
Mm. You know, I can imagine that walking a beat in the housing project is really tough, but narcotics has also got to be a tough beat.
Well, it is. But for me, it was also kind of refreshing because you only dealt with criminals. You weren't dealing with all these domestic disputes and emotionally disturbed people and traffic tickets and arguments and things like that. You were just dealing with criminals, and at the time it was a very pleasant change. You didn't have to be a politician anymore. Cops, you know, a beat cop always has to be a politician. You just kind of catch the bad guys, and it's pretty technical. I did that for a while. It was interesting. I mean, drugs and domestic violence, sir. If you got rid of them, you could send 2/3 of the cops in the world home. I mean, those are the things that drive, the violent crime and the killings and shootings and so on. So that was good to do, but in a way, I came to narcotics is a little bit abstract in its way, or it's, you might want to call it, it's environmental. You're making it, you get a dealer, you get a crew, you get them off the block, and you make the neighborhood or the community in some way a little bit safer. But I have real life victims now. I'm back with, complicated, regular, messy people. Somebody gets robbed, I'm the one who talks to them. I'm the one who's got to make it better. I'm the guy, win or lose, I'm the one who has to address the problem. And dealing with people again in that kind of immediate way, whether it's a homicide or an assault or a shooting or a robbery, is a more intimate connection that I kind of missed in narcotics. So it was, in a way, not exactly back where I came from, but it was the move to make at the time.
Yeah.
And we don't always get them, obviously. There's plenty of unsolved everything. But my youngest victim was a 2-year-old kid. He was with his grandmother. He was actually walking down the street, picking her a flower on 165th Street in the Grand Concourse, and he had this little charm around his neck. His father had given him, it was a little stop sign medallion that said, "I'll never stop loving you." And this crackhead came up to him, knocked him down, and robbed him of the chain. I mean, you see a lot of real depravity, but little things like that, where fortunately no one was hurt, it really takes your breath away. It makes you remember just how things can always get a little bit worse. So I have a 2-year-old victim who's not going to be able to say anything, and his grandmother didn't really see the guy either. So I did, the charm is distinctive. It was custom made, so I do have a little bit of a chance, that'll turn up or somebody will see it. But basically, this is not a case that's going to be resolved in all likelihood. But what I did was I got $2,000 in reward money. I had hundreds of posters put up in English and Spanish. They're all over the neighborhood. They're all over the subway. They're still in, 2 years later, they're still in the jail, the kind of in processing unit, central booking, we call it. So everybody in the Bronx who's been arrested for the last year and a half or 2 years, however old this is looking at that, thinking about it. And that made a big difference to the family, just to see somebody's working, eyes are open, feet are on the ground, and what wrong was done was not forgotten, and people looking out there, cops are trying to hard, And that made a difference to the family, I know that.
Yeah. I wonder if that something like that can make a difference in the life of a criminal, saying, "Cat, look at that. Somebody knocking down a 2-year-old."
Yeah.
And then pausing maybe and thinking about their own life.
I wish.
Unlikely.
I wish because,
I'll take off the rose-colored glasses now.
Yeah, well, everybody, that's a desperate crackhead, and I'm sure he didn't see himself coming to that. The nice thing about a case like that is even you'll get the drug dealers on the corner. You'll get the guys who are shooting each other and do it without a moment's sleep, killing somebody. They're the ones saying, "Well, that's where I draw the line." A case like that, you get everybody involved. Everybody's really genuinely going to tell you what they know, if they know anything. But nobody, see, that's where the real tragedy sometimes of criminals begins, is that they're blind to what they're, what they're doing and what they're about to do.
How would you define a good cop?
Oh, there's a lot of things. you one with his eyes open, and one who doesn't get discouraged, and one who goes back to work every day, even if yesterday was a pretty rotten one, and somebody who doesn't make their mind up before the facts are in, and somebody who can talk and somebody who can listen. There's a lot of things that go on.
Mm. Well, you say you can do it right and get it wrong at the same time. Maybe you'd expand on that.
Oh, constantly. I mean, from my identical twin case, I mean, in robbery now, the tricks of that, this business, is, are more and more apparent. I mean, identification is the primary way robbery cases are made. We'll show them pictures on a computer. The victim comes in, he was this tall, he was this age, he was black, he was white, he was this. And you show them picture after picture, and sometimes, I mean, I try and stay away from it until I have a little bit more to go on. I mean, if it's a bunch of kids, they tend to be local. If it's a single kid, I mean, this is a more serious a predatory guy who could be working anywhere, and he's not necessarily from the area. I mean, so you skew it one way or another. Well, people get it wrong. I mean, I've had, one person who looked at these photos, and he said, that's definitely the guy. So, no, you don't just say, okay, there's the picture, we'll go out and scoop him up. You find out, is he in jail, for example? That would be a good alibi. Why is his arrest photo in there? Has he done robberies before? Is he from this area? Does this make any sense at all? And one guy, got picked out, and he's very, very certain. I mean, he's pretty distinctive. I forget if he had a big nose or anything, but he wasn't just the most average-looking guy. And he'd done a bunch of robberies before, and he lived in the area, and everything made sense. And so I went out to look for him, and I actually saw him on a street corner where he was sitting on a stoop, and I said, you've got to come with me. And he took a little while to get up. I said, what's the matter? And he said, did you know? No, what? He had no legs. He had two prosthetic legs. Mm-hmm. I said, tell you what, you relax. This is not the guy who did this robbery, who ran away on two legs of his own. But people are, people are convinced of things, and sometimes they think they're doing you a favor by, getting somebody, and sometimes they feel pressurized. Often it's the reverse. You know that somebody sees them, but they're afraid of being wrong and picking out the wrong person, which is certainly an honorable instinct, but sometimes it paralyzes people. So it's a tricky business. Is that the guy who did it? Look him in the eye. Some people have... don't have enough confidence, and some people have too much.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Chicago, line 4. Go ahead.
Hi. You said earlier that you read a lot of cop novels. Have you read Linda Fairstein's novels?
No, I don't. I read mostly cop nonfiction. But I've talked with Linda Fairstein. I certainly admire her. She's a great prosecutor. But no, I haven't read her books.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I want to go back to one of the reasons that some folks don't respect cops, don't like cops, and those are folks who have suffered at the hands of bad cops. How effective is the department in New York City in identifying those cops and getting them out of the force?
I don't know. There's certainly always room for improvement. You always hear about things that go wrong, and a lot of times you just sort of catch your breath and say, oh my God, how did that happen? How did this guy do, how is this guy still working? And other times you say, wait a second, it's not that simple, or it's not like that. In terms of corruption, it's pretty matter of fact. This is your money or it's not your money. In terms of, and people are wrong and they're right, and cops overwhelmingly, in my experience, have pretty matter-of-fact opinions on that subject. In terms of force, that's where it gets tricky, because it's always, this is something we do, something we have to do, whether it's shooting a gun or fighting somebody. So that's where it's a matter of degree in a situation that, those are the tough calls, but cops are generally much more reluctant to judge, even if you know, force was used, or somebody's killed in circumstances that aren't what they appeared at the time. I don't know. I mean, I think they do a pretty good job. Obviously, things keep on going wrong to some degree, so it's hard to say.
The infamous cases like Amadou Diallo and Abner Louima, have those cases changed the department?
You know what? I don't think they have. And, you know, I don't know if they should have, and I don't know. I mean, there was always a rule against raping prisoners. It wasn't as if that was allowed before Louima.
Yeah.
I mean that was an atrocity, and was an awful thing, and there's not too much complication about it. There's complication about what the other guys did, and did this guy commit perjury, did he have help or whatever, and I don't think anybody's very satisfied with finding out what exactly happened with the other people. Diallo was, again, one of these much more difficult situations where these cops who were out after a rapist or in that area because of a rapist who had raped 51 women in awful ways. I worked on the task force to get that guy, and I was through the crime scenes and just seeing, you know, sometimes two and three women at a time at gunpoint and the vacant lots in wintertime, and just really horrible, horrible things that had gone on. And these guys were out to do good to get that guy. And in a darkened alley and sudden movements and one guy yelling out gun and being wrong and falling down, and, I mean, something that takes seconds to happen, this terrible, terrible thing happened. This innocent guy is killed. And that was, in no uncertain terms, a tragedy. But the way that was covered, I think, was an absolute disgrace, because it became an international story that said the New York City Police Department is reckless or it's racist and there's some price we're paying for the increase in freedom or the increase in safety on the streets in New York for the drop in crime, when it was absolutely not true. Cops were shooting people far less in New York than they ever had been. They were shooting far less in other cities. This was not happening, and yet it was supposed to be a symbol of Giuliani's, you know, racism or indifference or the police department, and that just was not the case. And it was terribly unfair. I mean, then we had literally six stories. I'd turn on the news and it'd be six stories about Diallo and what does Sharpton say and what does this mean. And before they mentioned that we were blowing up Serbia at the time. this was not a great lesson in proportion or perspective, as far as I was concerned.
Hmm. Do you think cops who come from a family of cops are a leg up, or can that be a disadvantage?
I don't know. I think it's a leg up. I mean, in some sense, you have, even though you have, I think, an idealistic expectation. You know, if you look up to your father and you love to hear what he did, I heard that the children of doctors have a more realistic perspective going into medicine than people who are trying it. You know, obviously we can't make these hereditary jobs, but I think it's probably an advantage just being a little bit more familiar, literally, with what it is that you do and what hurts and what's great and what to hope for.
Yeah, hearing the stories. We're coming rapidly down to the end of the amount of time we can spend together today. You said you don't think your dad, who was a member of the force, then an FBI agent, would have approved of your joining the force. What about your mom?
Well, mom wasn't too happy going in. I mean, nobody, even the people who live in the South Bronx don't want their kids to grow up and pound a beat in the South Bronx. It's rough stuff sometimes, but she's definitely happy now. You know, it's you do what you got to do, and I gave police work a try. That's been going on for close to 10 years now, and I've loved it when it's been lovable, and I've also been able to write. So, I haven't been denying my talents, as mom would probably phrase it.
And your sisters and your brothers, what do they do?
Both of my sisters are teachers, and one brother is a lawyer, and one brother works at a bank.
Hmm.
So we're all nearby in New York, in close family.
Yeah. Well, the best to you and your family. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Edward Conlin has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a detective with a robbery squad in the New York City Police Department. He's also a writer. He's the author of the memoir Blue Blood, which is now out, published by Riverhead Books. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much. Last kind of a mixed day at the Board of Trade. The oil seeds, soybeans, the nearby is down just a little bit. The deferreds higher as you go on out in the corn pit. Futures were narrowly mixed, but the wheat pit had a pretty good sized day on hand for the day, up 16 cents, actually 16 and a quarter in the nearby May contract, and the rest of them followed along for the day. May wheat had a high of 404, a low at 390, settled 403 and a half. They were up once again 16 and a quarter for the day. July futures, that's your harvest month. 413, the high, the low at 399, settled 411 and a quarter, and they were up 14. September contract at 418 high, low at 404, settled 416, up 13 and a half cents. In December wheat, 427, the high, the low at 414 and a half. Settlement price there, 424 and three quarters, up 13 and a half for the day. March futures of 2005, 429, the high, the low at 420. March wheat settled 429, up 12 and a quarter on the day. From the corn pit, the nearby May contract is your lead option. 319 and three quarters, the high, the low at 315 and a half. They settled just a quarter lower at 317 and three quarters. July futures in the corn pit, 326 and a half, high, low at 321 and a half. Settlement there, 323 and three quarters, down a quarter. And the September unchanged on the day, 323 the high, the low at 318 and a quarter. Settled 321 once again. That September was unchanged. December futures, your new crop corn, 322 and a quarter, high, low at 317. That 5 cent trading range, 5 1/4 cent trading range, settled just about in the center, 320, up a quarter for the day. March contract, 325 and a quarter, high, low at 320 and a half, settled 323 and a quarter, up a half. And the May futures, 326 the high, the low at 322 and a half, settlement for the May 2005 corn, 324 and a quarter, up a half cent. July futures were up three quarters on the day. They settled at 323 and a half with a high of 325 and a half and a low at 322 and a half. And 2005 December corn settled 279 and a half, up a half cent, had a trading range of 280 to 278 and a quarter. May soybeans, or rather May oats for the day now, 173 the high, the low at 169 and three quarters, settled 171 unchanged. And July futures, 180 and a quarter the high, the low at 176 and three quarters, settled 177. They were up a half cent for the day. Now the soy complex. May beans, $10.52 the high, the low at 1033, settled 1038 and a quarter. They were down 3 1/4. July futures, 10.31 the high, the low at 10.11 and a half, settled 10.21 and a half. They were up a half. And the August, 3 1/2 higher, 9.63 the high, the low at 9.48, settled 9.56. Once again, that August contract up 3 1/2 cents. September, 8.43 the high, the low at 8.30. That 13 cent trading range settling 8.38 and a half, up 7 1/4. And November futures, 7.77 the high, the low at 7.60, settled 7.76, up 13 1/2. January soybeans, 775 the high, the low at 759, settled 774 and 1/2, up 13 and a half. In the March soybeans, 764 the high, the low at 752, they settled 764, up 11 for the day. May bean meal, 326.80 the high, the low at 319.80, settled 322.40, up 20. And July meal, 326 the high, the low at 318.60, settled 321.60, up 40. May bean oil for the day, 34.25 the high, the low at 33.65, settled 34.21, up 29. And the July futures, 33.74 the high, the low at 33.23, settled 33.58, and they finished the day 26 higher. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. Cattle were higher today while hogs and bellies finished lower. May feeder cattle, let's see here, 140 the high, 99.60 the low, 112.5 the settlement, that up 37.5. August, 99.90 the high, 98.60 the low, 99.55 the settlement, that up 32.5. September feeder cattle, 98.45 the high, 97.50 the low, 98 even the settlement, that down 30. May live cattle, let's forget that number here this afternoon, insufficient information there. June live cattle, 84.70 the high, 82.25 the low, 84.57 and a half the settlement, that up 237 and a half. July 87.50, the high, 86 even the low, 87.50 the settlement, that up 200. My suspicion is that May live cattle didn't trade today. August live cattle, 85.40, the high, 83.95 the low, 85.25 the settlement, that up 97.5. May lean hog, 74.80 the high, 74.02.5 the low, 74.57.5 the settlement, that down 65. June, 74.70 the high, 73.65 the low, 73.85 the settlement, that down 100. July lean hog, 75.40 the high, 74.60 the low, 74.87.5 the settlement, that down 67.5. August lean hog, 72.80 the high, 72 even the low, 72.32.5 the settlement, that down 75. May pork bellies, 117 the high, 114.70 the low, 116.75 the settlement, that down 25. The Dow up 44 points at 10,358. The NASDAQ up 23 at 1961. The S&P 500 up 7 at 1124.
This is Les Schulte, WILL's Director of Corporate Support. If you own or manage an agribusiness, you can help in supporting this valuable service on AM 580. To find out more information, give us a call at 217-333-0850.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Letitia from Ann Arbor, Michigan writes, Dear Dr. Science, when you watch a foreign movie that has been dubbed, where do the original voices go?
They don't go anywhere. As you know, when you wake up foreigners in the middle of the night, they talk normal. So essentially, there are two versions of any foreign movie, one released in foreign gibberish, and one shot in the middle of the night after the foreigners have been rudely awakened. As a sop to liberals and people who think a thing has intrinsic value because it's French, the foreign language version is the one that's usually released, with subtitles so you can feel like you're reading at the movies, thus killing two pretentious birds with one stone. Don't be fooled. All of these movies are shot in New Jersey. Nobody really talks like that. It's all a sham. And foreign movie fans are just victims of a massive con game.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science CD and master's degree mouse pad, call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655.